Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Want to make some easy money? This guy knows how.
It's $500 every single year.
That's grad student Jonathan Ping with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Jonathan says with very little effort, you too can pad your coffers with extra cash. Specifically,
it's $500 every single year.
So here's a quiz. What is Jonathan's secret? Does he A, park his money in high interest online savings accounts? 5% of 10 grand equals 500 bucks a year. Or does he B, pack a lunch instead of eating out? He also brews his own coffee. Or does Jonathan simply B, ask readers of his blog to send him one dime every week? We should note the blog consists entirely of photos he takes of his own belly. Give up, don't navel gaze. The answer's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
If money be not thy servant, it will be thy master. So, Sir Francis Bacon, what say ye about high-yield online savings accounts? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
One of the most common questions we get here goes something like this. I just got a $500 bonus. What should I do with it? Or my wife just inherited $9,000. What should I do with it? Well, there are all kinds of things you could do. Buy some stock, fund your IRA. But what a lot of us end up doing, assuming we don't spend it, is parking that money in a savings account for now. These days, there are lots of banks who'd love the chance to sit on your cash. And that means you can find some pretty competitive rates. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli went in search of a way to max out the interest.
Last year, I sold my apartment in New York City. The proceeds have been languishing in a savings account, collecting 4.6% interest ever since. I've ignored it until I find a new place to buy. But when I started to do my taxes, I realized I'd made enough in interest to pay for this very big splurge. Meet my new used car. It's a luxury and an indulgence funded by my inability to make a decision about my assets.
The banks love you. They call you dumb money.
That's Todd Davenport of the industry newspaper American Banker. He says dumb money is passive cash the banks put to better use while I'm just letting it sit around. And he says some banks are so eager to get their hands on that dumb money that they're happy to give me a better interest rate than the one I'm getting now. Laura Bruce of Bankrate.com says I didn't even have to leave my home to find one.
The online banks are really fighting for these deposit accounts, raking in the money and the customers.
Bruce says customers who aren't afraid of doing transactions online are starting to get turned off by brick-and-mortar banks.
They're not content to put their savings account in a bank that's paying them a quarter to a half percent, which is just a sin.
She says in order to get your business, a lot of online banks are dangling the promise of a savings account that'll earn your money 5.05% or even better. Bankrate.com ranks the top interest rates that are out there on its website. The honor roll, please. In Cleveland, Ohio, one bank offers 5.36%. Another in Queens, New York, promises 5.3%. But Laura Bruce says not everyone with a savings account feels the need to be at the head of the class.
It's definitely worth opening up a high-yield account to start with. But just because your bank then isn't offering the highest yield doesn't mean it's really a good move to go and open up one somewhere else.
Unless you do have more than a few thousand dollars you want to keep liquid, or unless you like to chase interest rates like Jonathan Ping.
I mean, I was just moving money around left and right for a little while.
Ping's a computer science graduate student in Portland, Oregon. He and his wife are saving to buy a house, so every extra penny counts.
A lot of people don't really pay attention and they don't really think about it. If you actually, run the numbers, You know, if you have maybe $10,000 just sitting around, it's $500 in interest, you know, every single year.
Jonathan Ping took the time to read the fine print on all the offers. He found some banks have better rates but have less flexibility when you want to take the money out. Others let you write checks and give you an ATM card. Ping blogs about his experiences at mymoneyblog.com. He even created the ultimate interest rate chaser calculator so you can see what you'd earn if you do switch banks. Another thing to consider when you shop for a better interest rate, teaser rates like the 6% HSBC is offering right now are just that, designed to get you in the virtual door. Now, you may feel it's worth it to move your money, only to have the rate drop back down after a promotional period. But then again, as Todd Davenport of American Banker points out,
the difference between $100 and $200 becomes a little bit less consequential, unless you are devoted to what can be the full-time cause of squeezing the penny as hard as you possibly can.
Even Jonathan Ping gave up that squeeze and recently settled down. He chose a regional bank with an online presence that offered a good, solid rate. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at NASDFoundation.org.
Lisa just told us how banks compete to get hold of your cash, but once they get it, you might notice something. Say you pay a bill. Most times the money's out in minutes, but when you put something in your account, it can take days to credit. Blame it on the Check 21 law. Congress passed it a while ago to help banks quickly process checks and payments, but it does absolutely nothing to speed up deposits. Jean Ann Fox is with the Consumer Federation of America. Jean Ann, why does our money amble in and then just run out?
When Congress passed Check 21 to speed up check processing, they failed to speed up access to deposits for consumers, and the Federal Reserve has not changed the check hold period for 16 years.
Why is that? What's the benefit of this to banks?
Banks can make money on the funds that they have available between the time that your deposit clears and before they have to make it available to you. It also gives the banks more time to be sure that no deposited check is fraudulent or isn't going to be covered. But the deposit hold rules even apply to cash. So if you walk into a bank today and deposit cash over the counter with a teller, the bank doesn't have to make that available to you to spend for 24 hours.
What about electronic transactions? Is it any different if you're banking, say, online and you pay your bills that way? Is there any difference whether it comes out faster or slower that way?
Well, you should assume that any time you hand over your debit card or you direct your bank account to pay a bill electronically or you write a check, that you have to have money in the account. You can't assume that there's going to be any time delay. Although when you do pay bills electronically, if the merchant or the landlord can't receive electronic funds transfer, there may be a paper check generated and put in the mail to that person. But you may not know that.
So even though you're doing things electronically, the bank is actually cutting checks.
It depends on whether the person being paid can receive an electronic funds transfer.
So the banks are making money then as well because people perhaps don't understand the system and they're bouncing checks. And then, of course, they get hit with extraordinary fees.
The biggest estimate I've seen is a couple of years ago from a bank consultant who said that banks and credit unions take in over $30 billion, with a B, in bounce check and overdraft fees from consumers who don't have enough money in the bank when the transaction hits and has to be paid.
So really, there's nothing that consumers can do about this notion that there's no float for them, but yet the banks take advantage of a float for themselves when there's a deposit.
Well, there's always something you can do. you need to ask your bank if they will make your deposit available to you as soon as it clears. You can also speak to your member of Congress about changing the check hold period to reflect the modern era of electronic funds transfer. I mean, the rules we have today were set in 1990, and money moves at the speed of light now. It's just consumers who are not benefiting from that.
All right. Jean Ann Fox, thank you so much for coming in and for the great advice.
You're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Rule number one at a dinner party, never ask what kind of money people make. Oh, and never serve 10 at a table that collapses. Long story. But we're all about breaking the rules here. So we invited Donna Rosato of Money Magazine to join us. The latest issue looks at the best way to find out what your coworkers earn. So Donna, you've decided to do the salary snoop. Where should you start?
You can go to those salary websites that kind of give you a general idea, but they're just not specific enough. So have a conversation with a colleague or a peer. It's often good to talk with someone who is no longer at your company. They may be less inclined to feel awkward about talking about something now that they're at a new place, and invite them out to lunch. But don't just shoot out and say, hey, how much did you make when you were here in this job?
At least not before you order.
Right, right. Or, you know, after you've paid the bill.
Right.
But a good way to ask is, look, I'm trying to, you know, understand whether I'm being fairly paid in the job that I'm doing. I know you would probably have a good sense of that. Can you tell me what you think the appropriate range for this job is?
What about your actual colleagues at work? Is it something that you should avoid asking them about, or are there situations where it might work to actually ask each other what you're making?
One of my colleagues has a great tactic that he suggests. It's sort of like a party game. After work, say you go out with a group of colleagues for a drink, maybe you could get the salary conversation going and then invite everyone to write their salary on a slip of paper, you know, fold it all up, put it in a hat, mix up the hat, and read the numbers out loud.
Wow.
My colleague swears by this. So, you know, it'll give you the information that you know without hurting anyone's feelings or exposing anyone.
So there are certainly some things to think about before you go into this conversation.
That's right. And another tip I would suggest is, you know, obviously most people want this information because they're thinking about a way they can get a raise.
Mm-hmm.
It's also helpful for you to just think about your own standing in the company. Get a sense of how valued you really are before you start getting resentful if you're making less.
If you do go into the boss armed with the information about, well, you know, I'm making less than Joe Smith, who's doing my same job, aren't there risks involved in doing that sort of comparison in front of your boss?
It is never a good idea to go to your boss and say, I want more money because so-and-so is making more than I am. Because the boss might just shoot back and say, he makes more because he's better than you are. Knowing what people make is just information for you to understand. You understand the range for the job and you're not quite there. You want to use that information, but it has to be built on a foundation of you being valued and a base of good accomplishments.
Donna Rosato, you want to tell me what you make?
Maybe over drinks sometime.
Fair enough. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Tess.
You can find a link to the Money Magazine article on our website, marketplace.org. Early retirement is in sight. Now, how do you make your money last? Chris flexes your finances in the mailbag. And sometimes working in a church isn't so heavenly.
I filled the back of a ton truck with pigeon guano. That was unexpected.
A day in the work life of a steeple repairman. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Christians celebrate Easter this weekend. Lots of Americans will flock to their local church for worship. They might take a moment to remark on how nice everyone looks in their Sunday best, but they probably won't pay much attention to how the church looks. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a guy who's paid to do just that. He fixes steeples. We caught up with him this winter in his workshop.
This came from the Castine Historical Society. It's a cupola. Some people call them steeples. 1850s, had been repaired in the 70s. It was leaking and rotten. Oh, I'll be working on this the rest of the winter. Hi, I'm Bob Hanscom. I'm a steeplewright, and I live here in Green, Maine. Steeple jack is the common term. You had your wheelwrights, shipwrights, and I thought, why not a steeplewright? And I came up with that in the very beginning and then just stuck with it. I went to Southern Maine Vocational Technical Institute. I had built houses for 8 years. Then the interest rates went to 22% for construction loans in 1981 or 82, right in there. And my partner and I both went to work at Bath Ironworks and got laid off in a year. So I went back to Pound & Nails and Turner Village Church. They needed some work done on the steeple, and so they were good enough to let me do it. Oh, it was fun because it was all brand new. Whole experience was new. I've learned how to move 8x8 timbers, 12, 14 feet long, that weigh several hundred pounds apiece, from back of a truck to the top of a tower by myself. I have a crane made out of an old sailboat mast with a big winch on the side of it. Most everything I work on is 150, 200 years old, and there are a lot of Paul Revere bells. Paul Revere had his own foundry and business and manufactured bells. The foundry stamped the name right in the side in the ear. I like the Byzantine domes, that sort of thing. You know, they're all interesting. That's part of, I guess that's it. Again, they're all different. You don't run into one that's exactly the same as the next one, ever. I had one steeple that had about a foot of pigeon guano up above the ceiling in the spire. So when I took the ceiling down, I filled the back of a ton truck with pigeon guano. That was unexpected. Steeples, they run from $30,000 to $100,000, my own personal yearly income. I don't know, $50,000 maybe. It varies year to year. I have a hard time watching somebody else do what I do. You know, running around up high. My grandson's interested. I don't think I'm going to, I don't know. I think I'd have a hard time watching. Back in the days of building expensive houses, some of the people you deal with are not as nice. And I've really never run into people in 22 years that have been nasty or didn't pay their bills. You're just dealing with nice people all the time.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Sarah Nix.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
A whole lot of beautiful minds bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, H-1B visa. The H-1B visa is a permit that lets highly skilled foreigners work in the U.S., people like scientists, engineers, and other brainiacs. The U.S. Immigration Service hands out 65,000 H-1Bs per year. Last Monday morning, the service started accepting applications for this year's batch. Hours later, they had to stop because a record 150,000 people had already applied. How will the service decide which of these folks are brilliant enough to deserve an H-1B? A computer will pick them randomly. Smart.
I'm Tess Vigeland, and here to join me, as always, is not just a man, but a superman. He's Chris Farrell, our economics expert, and he'll set your financial house in order in record time. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you doing, Tess? I hope I can live up to that billing.
Leap tall bank accounts in a single bound. Something like that. All right, before we get into answering your questions, take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there, or you can give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. And we've got Charles on the phone from Roselle, New Jersey. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, but I have a question.
All right, well, that's what we're here for. Right, Chris?
That's right.
And I think my question is not the usual type that you get. I've been listening to your show since I discovered it and been hoping by osmosis to sort of accumulate some knowledge about how to deal with money. I find myself in the odd position of being 51 years old and about to retire in 2 months with a full pension.
Well, that sounds like you've taken a lot of advice very well.
Well, neither of these things I ever expected in my life to see. It's from the same job, and it's just 1 year, one half by after another.
What industry have you been in?
I work in the auto industry.
Wow, so you've actually done well in an industry that's been struggling.
That's been struggling. In fact, my plant just closed. So I have, but I was one of the lucky ones. And this is a pension that has a cost of living, has a prescription program, and a medical program. Those are the good things. They stay with me once my pension checks start. But I have no reserves. I know there's a lot of people like myself who are, you know, tail-end baby boomers who are all going to reach my age around the same time. And a lot of us just never thought we'd be here and didn't save.
So, Charles, is your question what to do with that money once you've kind of got it socked away?
Settled and it's starting to roll in on a regular basis. How can I make it more than what it is?
I have a couple thoughts. The first thought, and just listening to this conversation, and I think a lot of people in your circumstances, is to really to think about what it is you're going to be doing. You have an enormous savings cushion by working 30 years with this company. Plus, as you mentioned, you have what is really valuable, the healthcare, the medical side. If you didn't have that, then I'd be giving a much more draconian discussion or advice, because that's where people can really get hurt as they do get older. In terms of where do you put the money, I would sort of think of two categories. I mean, one category is your classic cash, just because you may want to travel, you may have a health issue, even though you have good coverage. And Tess knows that I like these funds. They come under different names. They're called lifestyle funds, target funds. And you may set it up as a Roth IRA. You may set it up as a SEP IRA, which is an IRA for the self-employed. You may decide that you don't want to do it in an IRA form. You'd rather do it just because your taxes may be low, that it may make more sense not to tie it into one of these retirement vehicles. The advantage of them is that you take a look at your risk tolerance, you know, how willing you take risk, put in what the length of time that we're talking about. So maybe you might be investing with a 20-year time horizon, and you'll be a little more aggressive. And then as you get closer toward the end period, it gets more conservative, and it makes very intelligent decisions for you. So the only decisions you're making are about time frame, risk, and how much money you can put into them. And then a lot of these funds have very high fees. You don't want them. They're very good ones with very low fees. Over 20 years, fees compound just like returns do.
All right. So does that help you out?
Yes, it does.
And enjoy your retirement at 51.
Thank you very much and have a good day.
Thanks so much, Charles. All right, how about a reach into the email bag? We've got John and Elizabeth writing in from Brooklyn, New York. They're expecting their first child very soon, a boy, in the next few days, in fact. And they've been getting a whole bunch of offers for life insurance for the baby. Now, of course, my question is, how did all these life insurance companies even find out that they had a baby? But aside from that, they're not sure that this is necessary. So they're trying to think of a more positive spin on what they're calling an insurance policy, which would be starting an investment for the child, getting ready for the education, that sort of thing. So what is your advice here?
Well, there's no reason to buy an insurance policy in the child's name. I know it gets sold. I'm not a big fan of it. I do want to say, the parents should buy life insurance. But in the name of the child, forget it, because we have much better options today, much better options. 529 plan is one option. Say for the child's college education or whatever form of education that the child's going to have over time. You could set up a automatic savings program, investing in, as you know, I like broad-based equity index funds, S&P 500, Wilshire 5000. You know, you start doing that on an automatic basis over 18, 20 years, you're going to have some real money for this child. You could do it in your name, by the way, because if it turns out that your child truly is Superman and gets a full scholarship to college, well, if it's in your name, you can go ahead and use it for what you want.
What about, you always hear about trust funds. Is that really a vehicle that's really for the wealthy?
You know, my feeling on trust funds is that, you know, they're oversold. I think like the 529 plan is much better than setting up a trust. I mean, think about an UGMA, Uniform Gifts to Minors Act. I mean, essentially, that's really just a trust, but it's a very simple trust. Well, 529, in most cases, is a better plan than a Uniform Gifts to Minors Act account. Trusts, unless you're wealthy, let's not go that route.
All right. Well, we're here to give you real-life solutions to difficult situations. And, you know, we're even available as babysitters if you need us.
That's
maybe not.
You are.
Maybe we should stick to financial care for right now. Just click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Well, you know, as a public radio show, we're considered a not-for-profit business. But there are lots of different kinds of nonprofit companies all over the world, big, small. And our next caller is actually in the process of creating her very own nonprofit. Jill is calling from Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Jill.
Hi there.
So what are you trying to do?
With my nonprofit organization?
Yeah.
Or with my life?
let's start with the nonprofit.
The nonprofit is called the International Breast Milk Project, and we ship donor breast milk from the U.S. to children orphaned by HIV in Africa.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you get interested in that?
Well, I just had a freezer full of milk, and I just read that orphans in Africa had a 6 times greater chance of survival if they received breast milk, so I became hell-bent on sending my milk there. And when I did that a year ago, I guess other moms kind of caught on, and it became kind of this thing that I learned there are a lot of other moms worldwide that wanted to do the same thing. So I had to start a nonprofit and kind of decide if I wanted to make a lot of money or have more of a rewarding career, but no money.
How did you even get this launched? I mean, there are all kinds of factors here, including shipping and how you keep things cold and getting them to the right places. How did you get started on that?
Well, logistics was definitely the biggest challenge. And just after a few months of researching, and I got FedEx to donate the last shipment. And I work with a company called Prolacta Bioscience in Monrovia, California. And they take care of all of the shipping, the cold storage, so that there's temperature monitors in each cooler. They blood test all the moms, process it all, test it, make sure it's 100% safe, and basically take care of the online applications and everything.
Wow. Do you ever think you'd be running a nonprofit?
No way. But it's awesome, I have to say.
Well, congratulations.
Thank
it sounds
you.
Like a terrific project. So tell us what your question is for Chris today.
Well, basically, I quit my job in medical sales to run my nonprofit. And of course, in the meantime, it's been a little more difficult to make ends meet, especially with my husband being in medical school. Actually, he's not in medical school. He's in residency now. I should take that back. My question is it better to continue to save all of our money for retirement or take some of the savings that we have built up to pay off our credit card debt?
Boy, Chris, this is a very common question of whether to pay off credit cards or whether to go ahead and keep things in savings.
That's right. And for every season, there is a priority. Now, do you really think, is it 6 months? Is it a year before we're going to be able to start paying it off?
It would be September would be when he starts moonlighting. And I think that there's probably a lot of other medical students or residents that have a unique situation in that we're really poor now, but we know in a few years it's going to be a lot different. So how do we manage our funds until then?
My first big thought is that both you and your husband are making huge investments. Because we're talking 6 months, 9 months, you're not going to make that much of a difference in terms of your, you know, the standard of living in retirement or how you're doing, but you're going to relieve some financial pressure for you. And then those credit cards are really there more for emergencies. So I would just say, hey, relax, pull back on the savings. And then once he starts making the money, you see what the money is, then start saving again.
So, Jill, are you not paying yourself at all through this business?
No, I'm not. I'm not. And that's a common misconception, too, is that a nonprofit is just like a hobby that people do for fun. But it's really being a social entrepreneur and investing your life in something to make a difference.
Well, tell you what, let us help you out a little bit. Why don't you tell us your website?
Oh, thank you. Breastmilkproject.org.
All right. Well, there you go. Best of luck with it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, guys.
Well, we're not physicians, but we do have the prescription to heal your financial pains. Give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, let's hit the email bag one more time. We've got Gail from Lennon, Michigan, and her parents are very involved in investing, and they created one of those UGMA accounts that you just mentioned a little bit ago for their six grandchildren, a trust fund. And these are the basis of the grandkids' portfolios. Now, Gail's parents passed away recently, but the accounts still have the grandparents' names on them. The grandkids are almost all over 18 now, so how does she go about changing the names on these accounts?
In most states, for UGMAs, they transfer to the kids at age 18.
So if they have an UGMA, does that mean that the names, that the grandkids' names are already have already been transferred?
That would be my guess that it's already happening, but I would just simply contact the financial institution that they have the account with, and I would contact them because it's a fairly routine procedure, but you'd want to make sure that it's going to happen. Depending on how the accounts were set up and the age and all the transfer, it still could be part of their taxable estate. Again, probably a fairly minor deal, but I would contact the financial institution, and it should be fairly straightforward and simple.
And for the kids who aren't yet 18, that would just happen automatically when they hit that birthday?
Yes, it is their money. And by the way, this is the big criticism of UGMAs, and people have very divided opinions on this, which is it used to be a way to save for college. I mean, that was typically how they were set up by middle-class folk, middle-class families. This was before 529 plans and Coverdales and all that. Of course, the big risk is the money truly is theirs. And, you know, the exaggeration is if they want to go to Europe and hitchhike, they can do that.
Right.
So that's why 529 plans, besides there are greater advantages to 529 plans, but one of the reasons why 529 plans or Coverdales have become so popular is that if you are setting the money aside, it has to be spent on a qualified education purpose. You can't use it and hitchhike around Europe.
Oh.
You know, life's a bummer sometimes.
Well, it's a bummer that that's all the questions we can take on this week's show. Do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit the contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much for all the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
When there's something strange in your W-2, who are you going to call? The Coglianos. We meet three generations of tax accountants.
Years ago, when they came in, they had one piece of paper, and that was a W-2 form. Now everybody has interest, dividends, stock sales, and it's a different ballgame entirely.
And from greenback to green thumb, how to save money in your garden. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Okay, folks, if you still haven't done your taxes, time to sit down, get out the calculator, and do some math. The deadline is April 17th. You could also go to your nearest tax preparer, though they may not be able to fit you in at this point. So far this year, tax professionals have prepared more than 37 million returns, hundreds of them by a guy named Cogliano. Make that three guys by name of Cogliano. Ashley Milne-Tite sent us this sound portrait of a family of tax accountants.
Mr. Cogliano's office. Yes, he's still here, Mrs. Filippone. He's inside with Angelo. Yes, do you want to talk to them? Okay.
My name is Angelo Cogliano, Jr. Right now I am 80 years of age and I've been doing this for 60 years. My father had wanted me to be an attorney, and just didn't work out. I played too much baseball. This worked out for me. I just took over from my dad because I was always in the office. When I was a youngster, right from school, I would come to the office. Years ago, when they came in, they had one piece of paper, and that was a W-2 form. But now everybody has interest, dividends, stock sales, houses, and it's a different ball game entirely. It's a different ball game entirely. You've got to spend time now with the client. Although, even years ago, I spent time with them. They ball me out because Dan does three to my one. He does.
My name is Dan Cogliano, and I'm an income tax accountant. I've actually been preparing taxes since 1975 when I got out of college. My mom passed away in 2002, and it was kind of time for me to go in with Dad full time. So I've been with Dad now for just about the better part of 5 years. I'm almost 30 years younger than him, and I'm exhausted now and at the end of each tax season. My father did it alone for years and years and years without help. Up until the last 15 years, he did not even use a computer. He did this in pencil, by hand, calculating everything arithmetically. There is never anyone who has touched a tax return besides a Cogliano. It's basically been Dad and me, and now we have David. But there has never been any outsourcing, if you will, or anyone hired part-time. None of that.
My name is Dave Cogliano. I can't remember a time when I wasn't here during the tax season. You know, it was fun to hang out with my grandfather. When I was young, he was always the guy to kind of give me advice and pull me aside. And he was another father figure for me. And we started golfing together. And we kind of took our relationship out of grandfather-grandson. And more became, he's one of my best friends, and I get to hang out with him a lot. So obviously seeing what he does and seeing how much the clients love him and trust him and take his advice is something that I thought that I would like. And I'm seeing it more and more because people are starting to listen to me and take my advice. The majority of the stuff that I do is corporate related. I do some of the clients that will see me. A lot of them don't even want to look at me because I'm the third generation. Some of them still won't even see my dad. They're just that loyal to my grandfather.
Just last week I had two guys come in. One was 94 and the other fellow was 93. Both of them, they have never had anyone do their tax except me or my father. You do right by the people, and they come back to you.
We've got photos of the Coglianos on our website, marketplace.org. While you're there, download our latest podcast, The Marketplace Money Tax File. This month, we've got some answers to some of your tax questions. That's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
It's finally springtime, though you wouldn't know it in the eastern half of the country. So for those of you suffering through April snow showers, a little audio relief today. We're talking gardens with Amy Stewart. She's the author of a new book called Flower Confidential. Amy recently visited my garden in Pasadena and gave me the dirt on how to grow a bounty of blooms without breaking the bank. Welcome to my house and my garden, Amy.
Thank you.
What do you think?
It's beautiful. It is.
My tulips finally came up, and my daffodils. I have some tulips over there in the corner. Bulbs aren't that expensive, but when you plant 500 of them, it starts to add up.
Yeah, well, they are kind of a long-term investment, though. I mean, at least with daffodils, they keep multiplying every year, and you can go out and buy a few dozen at a time every fall, and over time, it really fills in.
You know, one thing that I've found is that, I have my favorite flowers, and one of them is the Gerbera daisy. I tried to grow them in my garden,
and I couldn't do it. And there's not much that doesn't grow in my garden. And we're here in Southern California. We've got great weather. Most things grow here.
Right. That is such a good point. And I often mention the Gerber daisy as well as an example of a flower that is entirely about the cut flower industry and not at all about our gardens. You know, this is a flower that was discovered in just over 100 years ago, and immediately they started working on breeding it for the cut flower industry and creating these long, long stems and these real vivid colors. But it is a hothouse flower.
So that was a massive waste of money on my part.
Well, you know, you see those little Gerbera daisies in pots and they're already in bloom. But it's unlikely, unless you're a much better gardener than I am.
Doubtful.
that you're just going to get tons of them coming up in your garden.
Well, let's go ahead and go in the backyard because I have a couple of questions about things back there, all right?
Sounds good.
All right. Are you okay with
dangerous.
Dogs?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I'm going to... Kiara, come. Come on. In. Still very rambunctious. All right, well, here we are. This is your typical Southern California backyard. I've got a fig tree, I've got a pecan tree, a couple of orange trees. But one question, I want to get some new soil for my roses, and I've been wondering whether I should be going organic. I got to tell you, it is so much more expensive.
Bags of compost.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it really is the best investment in your garden that you can make. You know, there's this old saying among gardeners that if you have a dollar to spend, you should spend 90 cents on the soil and 10 cents on plants. So having healthy soil will actually make everything else that you're spending money on worth more and go farther.
What about where I actually buy my plants? Does that make a difference? I've got a garden center literally across the street from my house, which I have to tell you is very, very dangerous. But, you know, I wonder, should I be buying it there? I have bought some things at my local farmer's market, which definitely price-wise is a deal. Yeah. Or should I be going to like a big box store, like a Costco or something?
Well, let me tell you about one interesting thing that's changed in the nursery industry lately is that most of the big box stores have moved to a system called pay by scan, which means that the grower who grew that plant is not going to get paid until it's scanned at the check register and goes home with someone.
Hmm.
What that means is that very often the growers have to send people into the stores to take care of the plants. And what it has done is restricted the number of growers that can sell to the big box stores, as opposed to a small local independent nursery or even the farmer's market, where smaller growers who might, for example, have a better idea of what grows right here in your backyard and will be selling you those plants. And it's not always just what works for the climate. It's also what's most disease resistant.
So what kind of garden do you have?
Well, I have a garden. I have ripped out my lawn entirely.
Well, if you look around at mine, you see I might want to do that myself, actually. It's taking a long time to come back this year.
Well, when you have dogs, it's hard. But
that's true.
But I have chickens, and chickens are very happy to scratch around under the shrubs.
You have chickens in your garden?
I do.
So you ripped out your lawn.
I ripped out the lawn, and it's mostly flowering perennials. And I also grow a lot of salvias and other plants that attract a lot of bees and butterflies and hummingbirds. So I'm really interested in the garden as a habitat, you know.
I've struggled in my garden with how much annual planting to do. That gets very, very expensive when you're planting and digging up every year or every 6 months or so to go with the seasons.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think this is what happens to us when we walk into a nursery. I think we get sucked in by whatever is just really bright and in bloom.
Yeah, I've been there, especially when it's across the street.
Right. But the thing is, that's all they're really going to do. I mean, what you see, that's pretty much their whole life right there. And so I tend to sneak around to the back where you can find perennials that are, you know, in a little pot and all that's left are a few little twigs sticking up. But I know that next year there's going to be a giant shrub out of that little thing. So, but it is true. When you walk into a nursery, if you see a little plant with giant blooms on it, it has probably been overfed so that it will bloom prematurely and lure you. I mean, this is a plant whose goal is not to lure bees. It is to lure customers like us. And it's a good idea to ask, do you have one that's not in flower right now? Because that is probably a healthier plant to put in your garden over the long term.
Well, Amy Stewart, thank you so much for visiting me in my backyard.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to Amy's book on our website, marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I've been yammering on for 51 minutes. It's your turn. Now, I promise not to tattle, but many of you are not child-friendly when it comes to allowances. Last week, we aired a feature on doling out dollars to the kids. John Hubbard is from Fort Collins, Colorado. He doesn't buy that children need their own buying power.
It is a myth that giving your child money will somehow translate to learned good money management skills. Kids learn how to manage money by observing how their parents manage their money. Parents need to teach their children how to shop, how to save money, and how not to give in to impulse buying. This is done by example and discussion. Take the allowance money and put it into a college savings account and show your child how the money will grow.
But Dad, oh, never mind. Also last week, our Day in the Work Life segment profiled a job that only exists for the money set, your own personal wallet carrier, someone who carries around all your cash and stock certificates and credit cards, a living, breathing ATM machine. But did you catch the date on our story? Lori Brunner listens to us in Charlotte, North Carolina.
You almost had me. Although several aspects of the story seemed odd to me, like why would somebody need to wake someone else up to shop at Amazon.com at 3 o'clock in the morning when Amazon saves credit card information? I was almost willing to chalk up the wallet man profession as just another sign that billionaires have too much money until I heard that Joe King was the producer of the show.
One thing we never joke about is your feedback. Send us your comments, critiques, complaints. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact. Or you can call us. Our number is 877-ASK-MONY. That's 877-275-6669.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help us sort out what's smart, what is stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, a couple of weeks ago on this very show, I interviewed a guy named James Scurlock, and he made a documentary called Maxed Out, all about how the credit business preys on ordinary Americans. And there's another movie hitting theaters this week about basically the same thing. It's called In Debt We Trust. I know you've heard about it.
Yes, I have.
Well, here's a clip that's going to give everybody a pretty good idea of how the filmmakers feel about some credit lenders.
They're making 54% net profit. That is evil. They're making it off the poorest members of our society. That is evil.
Subtle. Yeah. I would say very subtle.
But also kind of true. I mean, there's this whole consumer culture that essentially promotes debt. Don't you agree it's gotten kind of out of hand?
Well, you know, Tess, I know that there is a circle of hell that is reserved for predatory lenders. That said, I don't want us to get carried away. You know, debt, except for in the very, very literal sense, is not a four-letter word. In fact, here's the straight story. Access to debt has paid off big by helping everyone, from the poor to women to minorities, participate in this economy. In fact, the American middle class was built on debt.
But how is that possibly a good thing, to build your middle class on owing everybody?
Oh, but Tess, if you go back, Randall Jarrell, wonderful poet, he was writing about, you know, America's addiction to debt. And, you know, he said, so imagine the Sistine Chapel. Well, in America, what God would be holding out to Adam, you know, is a checkbook or a credit card or, as he said, a charger plate. Well, that was in the early 1960s. And then you go back to the 1920s, and there was this innovation called installment credit. Mm-hmm. There was this whole thing, oh, debt. But the fact of the matter is, you buy a home with debt. You buy a car with debt. You know, the people who really tut about debt, they have a lot of money. They don't need to borrow. And what debt is, it's the weapon of the poor and the working class against the wealthy. Because there's a smart entrepreneur out there that doesn't have a lot of money, but has a good idea. And with access to credit, they can create that product and upset the world. And the thing about that has happened over our economy, just take the past 30 years. 30 years ago, you couldn't have gotten a credit card, Tess. You're a woman.
But maybe that would have been good for me.
Hey, that's your choice. That should not be the choice of some banker deciding, hey, you know, you're not a good risk, or, you know, we're not going to lend to minorities.
I agree with you. It can be good for some things, but I would say that entrepreneurial debt that you're talking about is completely different from putting all of our shoes and our groceries and our tax payments and everything on credit cards. And then if you miss one payment, all of a sudden your interest rate goes up to 25, 30, 35%.
All right. First of all, I disagree with you. I think that entrepreneurial debt is a lot more similar to investing in your home, even buying that car, because they're all investments.
Hmm.
Now, buying your groceries, now you and I can sort of agree. But where, I mean, I have friends who buy everything on credit cards. They pay it off at the end of the month.
Right. Well, good for them. But these movies are not talking about those people. They're talking about the people who get in deep trouble, aided and abetted by the industry.
Okay, the way you painted the picture, I would have to agree with you. I am no defender of the credit card companies. And we need regulation. And by regulation, I mean, look, I'm not telling what rate you can charge me, but I want to be able to understand what is going on here. Mm-hmm. What am I really signing on? And by the way, I don't want to have to be a graduate of Harvard Law School to understand that agreement. That said, there are always people that are going to fall into trouble. But why do they fall into trouble? It's not so much the debt, it's that they get divorced, or they lose their job, or they fall into ill health. Now, if we talk about ill health, I'll talk to you about universal health care coverage, far more important than what's going on in the credit market.
Yep.
We talk about the job market, I'm going to talk about wage insurance. So I'm not going to defend a lot of what the credit card companies do, but I do think that in the end, most consumers are reasonably smart with their money. There are tragedies, but when you look at the U.S. economy as a whole and the American middle class, broadly defined, because most of us consider ourselves middle class, they're not in deep financial trouble.
All right. The Straight Story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, we are indebted to you, as always.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, getting more from your financial aid package.
Families fill out forms. The data goes to financial aid officers who really look very carefully and thoughtfully about the resources they've got and try to match them up with what they determine to be the needs of the family.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.